Time is an illusion. Lunchtime, doubly so. Ford Prefect, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Capone.
And this is Reading Pop Classics, a podcast dedicated to popular modern books, pieces of literature that had a cultural impact, either currently or in the recent past, or maybe just ziplined through the zeitgeist for a screaming hot minute and then vanished into the myth. Today, we're talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which admittedly is not a book that was recently published. It first appeared as a radio show on BBC Radio in 1978. It was immediately popular, and the first novel appeared in 1979, and it has gone on to be a multimedia juggernaut in the ensuing 45 years, though, from that first novelization. That includes 6 novels, video games, comic books, numerous stage adaptations, TV series, including one on Hulu that was announced in 2019, and then, like a lot of shows, people, events, and businesses, was killed by COVID. There was a 2005 movie adaptation. The radio series came back with new episodes for the 40th anniversary. Stephen Hawking once voiced the computer character Deep Thought for a TV program. There's 2 asteroids named for characters in the series, as well as a fish and a moth species. The band Radiohead has named albums and songs for the series. There is an annual fan-created event called Towel Day that is celebrated on May 25th, coming up soon, so get prepared for that. And much, much more, from merchandise to collectibles to novelty songs. All of this sprung from the mind of a man named Douglas Adams. Adams was a writer and performer in England. He was discovered by Graham Chapman, a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, King Arthur from the Holy Grail movie, and Brian from Life of Brian, for you Monty Python fans. And they briefly became writing partners, Chapman and Adams. Adams got some sketches on Monty Python, the BBC show, and on one of their albums as well, and has the distinction of being one of only 2 non-Pythons to have writing credits on any of their material. His career after that struggled, though, until his sci-fi comedy series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, was accepted by BBC Radio and became an instant hit. Adams died young, sadly, at 49 in 2001. Rebecca, tell us, does The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy pass the Bechdel test?
It does not pass the Bechdel test. A few other, not at all, not even a little bit. A few other books that we have read, it is simply because there are very few female characters in this book. I believe that the only female character in this book is Trillian, formerly Tricia McMillan when she was an Earthling. And she does not have the opportunity to have a conversation with another female. This is a very largely male dialogue driven book.
Not only is she the only female character, she's got, what, 14 lines in the book?
Maybe.
She's barely a presence in the book. Like, she mostly serves for the sort of awkward introduction between Zaphod Beeblebrox and Arthur Dent, where Arthur already knows Zaphod, because Arthur was trying to chat up Trillian back when she was Tricia McMillan at a party, and Zaphod came up and said, "This guy's boring. I'm a spaceman. Come with me." And went off with the girl that Arthur was trying to have a conversation with. A party he gate crashed, which is apparently a thing. Gate crashing parties gets mentioned a couple times in this book.
Because Douglas Adams is British. I do feel like that's something that I hear about. Because I think that was in Eleanor Oliphant as well, which was Scottish, so not British, but
United Kingdom.
Within the United Kingdom, exactly.
The British Isles.
So I do feel like gate crashing is something that comes up as, like, are people just constantly going to other people's parties in the UK and that's rude?
I don't even know how you do that. Is it because they're at pubs? Like, you can't just wander into someone's house.
You can't just wander into somebody's house. But to me, parties are fun because there's people that you don't know there. And so, I mean, maybe, in certain extents, right? I mean, a smaller party, I guess, maybe you know everybody, but
maybe their parties are being held outside the home. Like, maybe they're in a place that you can access publicly. Like, because wedding crashing is a thing, but.
Well, that's true. We do have a whole very American movie about that. So that's a good point. But gate crashing, yeah, because I feel like that was an Eleanor. I do feel like that came up in Eleanor Oliphant as well. And you're right, it does come up more than once in this book.
Douglas Adams is British. He's very British. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, so the first time I read this, I read Ford Prefect's name as Ford Perfect for like half the novel before I started paying, before I paid close enough attention to realize I was just juxtaposing the letters in my head. Do you know why the, do you know why his name, there's a comment in the book that he had done really well blending in on Earth, except when it came to picking his last name and he chose, you know, Ford was fine, but then he chose Prefect as the last name. Do you know why that's weird? I didn't, I had to look it up.
If my Harry Potter memory serves me, a prefect, that's some that's like a school term, and that's like a school term in Britain or in the United Kingdom, I think. Like, so in Harry Potter, the prefects are like class leaders, and like I feel like you're kind of an and I get the impression that you're like a nerd if you're a prefect. Or at least one of or like one of Ron's brothers, right? Like one I can't remember his name now, but one of Ron's brothers is like the nerdy. Like the smart nerdy one, and like he's a prefect, their
Okay, that's
first
a deep,
year.
that's a deep pull. One of Ron's brothers is a prefect their first year there.
But it's mentioned several times in Harry Potter. It's that it's like I get the impression it's someone who's like a class leader. Like it's like the kind of like teen that adults like. It's like friends with the
Okay,
adults.
that's probably where this came from then. So the reason it's weird is that it's the name of a car. It's the name of a model of Ford in England. So it's like if he was here and his name was Ford Focus, if he was here in the
I
States,
got it. Okay.
or if his name was like Chevy Nova.
Right. Okay. No, that was a deep pull. I read it as like I read it as prefect. I Harry Potter immediately came into my mind.
Wonder if they named the Ford the prefect though, after like being like the leader of the, you know, a leader of your class.
A leader in your class. Yeah, maybe. Maybe so. I mean, 'cause so Harry Potter is not the only that is not the only United Kingdom reference I have. I mean, there are other books I've read where you know characters are at these like higher British
You
schools or higher United Kingdom schools where they mention
don't
prefects.
try, don't try and act like you know England. You know Eleanor Oliphant, Harry Potter, and that's it.
I know things about England. I'm an Anglophile. You don't know. I could be an Anglophile.
I wonder if England is upset that just sort of like we're more than Harry Potter. Like, you know, we're also J.R.R. Tolkien,
That's
and
true.
that's it. And that's it.
Come on, Britain is known for some absolutely amazing literary works.
I bet at this point, though, I bet it's New Zealand that is, we're more than Lord of the Rings, we're more than J.R.R. Tolkien, because I think most people probably think of the movies now more so than the books.
Yes, I know somebody who went to New Zealand for their honeymoon, partly because they wanted to go to New Zealand. Because that's a cool place to go, and partly because the groom was like a Tolkien head, as it were, a Lord of the Rings fan.
I struggled through all four of those books.
I
No,
couldn't.
I didn't struggle through The Hobbit. The Hobbit was a very short, whimsical delight when I was a kid. The rest of them, though, I don't get it.
Oh, I couldn't do it. I couldn't make it through The Hobbit, and I've never tried to go back.
I've read all of them, and I just, it's like if you, it's like, oh, this is my opinion. The Lord of the Rings series is like, oh, you enjoy wizards and like medieval fantasy things? Yes. Okay. What I'm going to do is make it like learning, though. I'm going to suck all the fun out of it and make it sort of a drudgery. That's what we're going to do instead of, you know, making it whimsical or fun. Oh, it's something I like, but you've made it like school.
But less fun. And you know, here and there I have this moment of like, man, I feel like I should pick up the Lord of the Rings. Like, I can't believe I haven't read this. I've read all of these other great things, all of these other famous works. And then like I'll pick it up in a bookstore and just be like, absolutely not.
Oh, it's such a drag. I disrecommend it. I know that that
Anytime
might
I
be the
pick them up
thing.
and look at them, I've seen parts of the movies over the years, and every time I see them, I think, man, I really don't want to read this.
I know we're going to catch heat because there's people.
And you know what? That's fair. If you're someone who loves Lord of the Rings, like I get it, and I'm sure that there is a reason And I love that. I love that for you. I love that for people that love Lord of
I
the
don't.
Rings. What a,
People go to the
you know,
mat for those books.
yeah, like what a great
They're a
series to have
drag.
gotten through. And part of the reason I love that for you is because you made it through all the books. And that's cool, 'cause I couldn't do it.
They should have just flown those eagles to Mordor and dropped the ring in. Anyway, we'll save that for our other podcast, the I Hate Lord of the Rings podcast. Today we're talking
Get back to Hitchhikers.
our other podcast, crapping on pop classics. So speaking of Trillian Macmillan having very little to do and very little to say in this book, one of the things that I want to talk about upon my reread, the first time I read this, I was younger, and I like it much in the way that you and I rewatched Monty Python and the Holy Grail over and over again. This was just kind of a fun comic reread that I could always pick up. But this book is barely a novel. So I read the first five books in this series before the posthumous sixth book existed. And like I mentioned, I was younger. It was a happier time in my life when critical analysis did not factor into my media consumption at all. And I didn't notice it, but this is really a series of skits that are very, very loosely hung on the framework of some of the thinnest characters ever committed to paper. Like, there's four human characters. They're all pretty exclusively reactionary characters, right? They mostly exist to receive information that the reader needs to know, or to have dry responses to like fantastical sci-fi concepts and things.
Yeah, I agree with you. There, so let me first and foremost, let me say I enjoyed this book because it was a delight. It was a delightful read. It was really funny. I remember in our last podcast, you know, we briefly talked about this book, you know, because this, you know, so for listeners, if you did not listen to our previous podcast, you should go back and listen to it when you're done with this. However, something we discussed, this was, you know, as we said, one of Kennedy's favorite books when we were kids. And I amazingly never read it. And it was always on my list, partly because I knew he liked it so much. And I don't know why I didn't pick it up. Or actually maybe I do. And it is that I've never been a huge science fiction fan. It's kind of rare that I'll pick up something that is sci-fi. Although I've been branching out a lot more recently and picking up more sci-fi books and developing some appreciation for them. But I think that was kind of what steered me away from this when I was younger. And, you know, to Kennedy's point, I wasn't picking up things for critical analysis. I was picking them up to read them because they interested me. And sci-fi didn't seem to be something that interested me. So I have a feeling that's why I just kind of kept skipping over this book, even though it was a favorite of his. And in our last podcast, we kind of talked about how the humor is very similar to Monty Python, humor, which was something that Kennedy and I consumed, over and over again. Particularly Monty Python and the Holy Grail was a real family favorite. Among the two of us, we still text each other Monty Python and the Holy Grail quotes, at random. And that was my favorite thing about this book was that the dialogue actually did really it strikes that same tone.
Yeah.
But to your point, and I mean, and they've collaborated, as you mentioned in the intro, they've collaborated, and that does come through in this book because to your point, there was a little bit of like throughout the book, I was kind of waiting for it to like congeal for the like the for the things to come together, and they do sort of.
Yeah, like what's the plot of this novel?
Yes, and they do sort of in the end. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, so to your point of like that, so if we're looking at the definition of a novel, yeah, this kind of this bare this maybe barely scrapes it. It is a little bit more of like this series of stories or skits or scenes.
And to be clear, I don't hate it. I enjoyed this just as much as I used to. I just realized as I was reading it that Arthur Dent, Ford Prefect, Trillian, Zaphod, they don't really do anything.
No,
Like
they're.
the novel doesn't have a plot. I mean, Monty Python and the Holy Grail actually very similarly is I suppose just a series of skits hung very loosely on the pull-through narrative conceit of King Arthur and his men looking for the Holy Grail. God appears in a cloud and tells them to go look for it. And so they do, which allows a series of funny scenes to take place. And I guess this is very much the same, which is interesting because it frees the narrative of the classic protagonist, which means that the real star of the show, I guess, is the skits, like the fun and funny ideas and set pieces that Douglas Adams just comes up with for like his gags, the things that are either like a paragraph or a couple of pages. Like those are the star, and you know, we get a couple pages of them and then we just move on. So that bits like the whale falling over the planet and having a long internal dialogue with itself, unraveling the nature of its existence and the world around it, which is like just a bizarre high concept thing to have in general. But gags like that become the focal point. The madcap universe that Adams keeps revealing little bit by bit is the real protagonist, the whale, the falling petunias, the evolution of the Vogons, deep thought, the computer, and the answer to life, the universe, and everything. Even I like the book series on God. Who is this God guy anyway? And one of the other titles is That About Wraps It Up for God.
Yeah, I enjoyed that as well.
The Pangalactic Gargle Blaster. Like all of these things become, because there is no actual plot or protagonist, all of these things can become the protagonist or become what we're tuning in for. Like that's what we're here for, is not, it seems, it's not whether they're going to save Earth. In the beginning, it kind of seems like saving Earth might be the premise, but then Earth
is
destroyed.
That's blasted away immediately. Right. Literally, right? It's blasted away immediately.
And at the end, we are taken to a place that makes planets. And for a second, you're like, oh, well, they'll make another Earth. Nope.
Nope. Also not doing that.
No, they don't.
And, you know, so it, you know, so this book is, like you said, kind of this series of little like vignettes that have come out of Douglas Adams' brain. And so I'm going to say this without having, so this is the only book in the series I have read. So I'm going to say this without a familiarity with the following four books, but knowing that there are four more books,
five.
Like, no, there's five more books. There's six books total.
One, this, I don't know if you count the sixth one. It was written after he died. It includes like some of his notes and some of his some of his work for another book, but it was mostly, or it was co-written or completed by another author and includes some of his like stuff. But there are six in the, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy.
Oh, which, I see. That's cute. That's fun.
Yeah, they keep that gag going,
they just keep
like
going.
on the covers of the books.
Oh, I remember. I remember having seen that.
One of them
the
says,
years.
I think the one that I had said the increasingly, or I had the series. One of them was like the fourth book in the, or the fifth book in the increasingly misnamed Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy.
Yeah, I remember saying that at our house. But so that it is this little series of vignettes. And so again, knowing that there are, I get five books apparently that come after it, I guess this can also be looked at as a little bit of like a scene setter, right? That like we start out on Earth for like the briefest period of time, and then we are thrown into like Douglas Adams' concept of space and the universe and in this, in his, you know, his particular brand of sci-fi and what that looks like. So something that struck me in this book, and this is a nice little delve into that, this book is really silly. This book is just like Monty Python silly.
It's
ridiculous, and it is far-fetched for science fiction.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like it's this play, almost this like spoof on science fiction, which I enjoyed. But then some of the like sci-fi stuff, some of the like the science part of it is really intelligent, like kind of scattered throughout the books. Like the way he'll like explain something or go into something does feel a little more realistically sci-fi.
It also takes, like I mentioned, the whale is like a very high concept, like analyzing its own existence and its own way of being. But even the gag about the guy who wrote the books, Who is God, or What is God? Who is this God guy anyway? That about wraps it up for God. Even the little like philosophical debate about the Babel fish, Babel. I don't know how I'm supposed to say that. It's a word I've only ever seen written down. The Babel fish, where it's that, well, God says that he'll exist, that he, that God's, that God's existence is predicated on you have to have faith that God exists. But the argument goes, the Babel fish is a giveaway. Only God could have created this. Therefore, you don't have to have faith, and therefore you can't exist. And the guy goes, oh, I hadn't thought of that, and disappears in a puff of logic. That's like a smart gag. Like, you have to, like, kind of know about you have to be ready for, like, debating the existence of God. You have to be familiar with the arguments about, like, God's the belief in a Christian God existing through the faith of the believer and all of that, to, like, to get to the punchline, to get to the punchline, poof, God had disappeared. God disappears in a puff of logic. And then the call back to the guy, to the book series, with, and that about wraps it up for God.
Yeah. So yeah, there are, like, there are these things in it that are really, like, this is clearly written by somebody who was intelligent.
Like, they're silly, but they're very, yeah, they're silly, high conceit, high concept jokes.
Yes.
Some of them are just, you know,
and
the Vogons. The Vogons
are
like
bad
poetry.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that. So these little vignettes, you know, that kind of make up this book feels a little, like I said, like, you know, once I got to the end of it and we're set up right for the next book with the closing line. So when I got to the end of it, it was like, I kind of looked at it as like, okay, so this first novel is a little bit of world building. And that's why some of these things are just a little, like, disconnected. That's why these stories are a little bit, I mean, not disconnected isn't quite the right word, because they do kind of fit together in the end. But, like, some of these things you could take out in the story, in the end story would still make sense.
But this isn't, like, and I'm saying it has no plot, which isn't a bad thing. It's not our first, like, Salvage the Bones doesn't really have a plot. And lots of books don't have a plot. In Salvage the Bones, the plot is what we know as readers, which is that Katrina was a devastating hurricane, and we know that the characters within the book don't know that, but that's kind of what passes for plot. That, and I guess whether or not she tells,
like, her family finding out about the pregnancy.
Yes, whether or not she tells,
whether or not she's
going to
tell Manny
or confronts Manny about it. But you know, in lieu of plot, we get character study and an incredibly deep sense of place. Slaughterhouse-Five, also no plot, really. That is the book that probably most closely resembles this book, with the exception of sort of the seriousness, I suppose, of the subject matter. But it's our other, that and Parable of the Sower are the two other sci-fi books we've done. Slaughterhouse-Five, also plotless. The non-existent plot in that one actually also gives us episodic events that the author wants to examine or satirize or explore, just kind of taking us to consideration of a deeper subject matter than this one does, which, as you say, is purely for the joy of just being silly.
Yes. And I mean, and I like that. I mean, this is very straightforwardly a comedy novel.
Yeah.
In my opinion, right? Whereas, like, remember we thought that Eleanor Oliphant was going to be funny, and it was a very funny book. I would say that until Hitchhikers, that might be the funniest book that we read, but it was very serious.
Yeah.
It did have a plot. It did have a story. It did have a character study, and it was the subject matter and stuff, and it was very serious. It just happened to be, and it was similarly funny, because it is also written by a UK author, right? So it did have a little bit of that same, like, comic comic timing to it a little bit. There are some similar back and forth conversations that are, to me, a little bit of a hallmark of like UK humor, which, like I said, I enjoy.
The only other straight comedy that we've done is Confederacy of Dunces, which is meant to just be comedy, but it is maybe the most plotted book of, like, the most heavily plotted of all the books we've done.
Yeah, because everything really ties up in that
Lots
book.
of strands, and all of the strands come together in the
All
end
of the strands
for,
come together in the end.
yeah. The other one that is pretty heavily plotted is Little Fires Everywhere, which gives
Yes.
us the ending at the beginning device, and then we move forward through that one. One of the other things that I just stood out to me in this read through was something that I really like in general, but the Hitchhiker's Guide to its I'm sorry, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy itself, like the actual thing within the book as a narrative device. I like it when books do this, like when they use a book or a text or a story or whatever kind of media inside the story itself. So in Hitchhikers, we get pieces of the actual guide, either from the narrator, or we get them diegetically in the story from if Arthur is reading them. In Slaughterhouse-Five, Vonnegut does it in a lot of his books. He does it in Slaughterhouse-Five, but he does it in a lot of the others with Kilgore Trout novels. He will
Right.
either like read pieces of them, or he'll summarize them, or there'll be parts from those books in Vonnegut books. In Confederacy of Dunces, John Kennedy Toole uses, like, there's letters that Ignatius receives, there's letters that he writes, there's the Poor Boy's Journal, there's his book of philosophy that he's writing on Big Chief tablets. Like, we get a lot of in-book media. Princess Bride, I think, pretty famously does it both in the book and the movie. Anyhow, I like that as a device when we have something like that, that is just, we step away from the main plot to get information from a secondary piece of
From
media
another
within the,
source.
yeah.
Something I enjoyed about the Hitchhiker's Guide, about the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide within the book, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So it kind of in its, so when I was reading the description of it, it was like I finished reading the description of it, like the actual device itself is essentially like a Kindle.
It's a Kindle with Wikipedia on it.
So there was that. Like I read it and was like, and I just think it's so interesting when you read, so especially if you read something that's like an older sci-fi book, like something that's just, pre, I don't want to say like pre-internet. I mean, the internet's been around for a while in some capacity, but I guess in the way that we know it now, in the way that we can have it on, that everybody has it in their home for the most part. We have it on laptops, we have it on phones in our pockets all of the time. Pre that level of technology just being like a given in our lives is probably the way we look at it now. When you read something that's older like this, where that was like, that's like unimaginable, I guess, almost, except that it's not, because like you read something like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and it's like, I'm reading it in 2024, being like, oh, so the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is an iPad
It's an iPad. It's a Kindle,
or a Kindle
really.
with.
It's a Kindle with Wikipedia on it, but it's
Where you can kind of
Wikipedia for
look up,
the whole galaxy.
where you can look up anything.
Adams famously got the idea for it when he was backpacking around Europe, as young Brits are wont to do. And he was sleeping in a field one night, or he was lying in the field drunk anyway, and he was looking up at the stars, and he had with him his, I can't remember what country he was in, but his like backpacker's guide to Germany.
Right.
And he was thinking to himself that it would be fun if there was a like a backpacker's or a hitchhiker's guide to the galaxy. And the reason I say that famously that's how it happened is because he also has said that he has no memory anymore, before he died, of course, that he had no memory anymore of that actually happening. But he had told the story so many times and heard the story back from people so many times that he had told it to, that he just decided it must have been true at one point, that that's where it came from.
Something else that struck me in that same vein of like, that same vein of Douglas Adams predicts the future. On page 168 in my book, Fouque is talking to the deep thought computer, and they're asking it questions, about like these other computers, these other like supercomputers over the years. Asking like how powerful it is, and Fouque says, "And are you not a greater analyst than the Googleplex star thinker in the seventh galaxy of light and ingenuity?" And so the fact that Googleplex was in there Okay, because something I want to talk about is the number of hilarious words that are in this book, which was my favorite part of this book. I've written some
Yeah.
down. I'll be going through them. And so Googleplex is a funny word, and it goes along with some of the other funny words in this book that he has come up with. Again, I made a list.
Googleplex is a real word, though.
Oh, is it a real word? I mean, is it a real word in 1979 when this book came out?
I'm going to tell you with some of the most fun irony I've ever had to Google it real quick while we're talking here, but I think Googleplex is a number. I think that's where Google came from, is from the number Googleplex.
Oh, okay. I'm looking up Googleplex right now. Okay, so yes, Googleplex is the name given to a large number, which is like, okay, I'm not a math person. 10 to the 10th power, and then the 10th power is to the 100th power. And I know that there is a way, I know that there is a mathematical way to say that, and I'm very sorry that I do not know what it is.
It doesn't matter. No one but the dinguses who invented Google care.
They don't know what it, they don't know what it's called when the to the power has its own little to the power. But anyway, okay, so
I
it
believe
is the
I
name,
I
but it is
don't know what it's
spelled
called. I don't know what an exponent is called, but
an exponent on an exponent. I couldn't even think of the word exponent off the top of my head.
it's
But
probably
that
called like a StrataNet or something, or a NanoNet. It's probably got another, like an
but that
exponent, and then like
word
a dexponent.
but that word is Googleplex, so Googleplex.
I think that's where
But that is probably where
the
they
two
got the word.
Google fellas got the name Google. Is not from Hitchhikers. I think it is from the word Googleplex. Although, you know what? So many people, this book has such a long tail. Elon Musk is constantly referencing it in all of his space stuff. Like all the things that he shoots into space have like little Hitchhikers references buried within them. Like I read at the top, there's asteroids named for this and species of animals, and you know, OK Computer, the Radiohead album, is named for the way Zaphod talks to the computer on the Heart of Gold ship in here. And Paranoid Android is named for
Marvin.
Marvin, which,
Nice.
by the way, do you have someone who wins the book for you? Marvin wins the book for me. Like that's
Marvin is hilarious.
Marvin is just dropping threes from the half court line over and over and over again. He is throwing heat in every scene that he's in.
Legitimately, every line that comes out of Marvin's mouth is hilarious. There are no throwaway lines. Everything that comes out
No,
is
everything's
just
great.
is so good.
In the
It's so good
movie,
for someone who has for someone who has so little, like he doesn't contribute anything like plot wise necessarily. And just every line that comes out of his mouth is great.
he talks to that other ship and it kills itself.
Oh yeah. Which is how they get saved in
Yeah.
the end.
Because the life support systems on the two guys who are holding them down go out. Alan Rickman does the voice in the 2005 movie, and he's perfect for it. Speaking of Harry Potter, because that's the only thing we've determined you know about England prior to reading this book.
I know other things about England. I was the one who brought up British humor.
He's Snape. Just
He is
so we could
Snape.
tie it back to the one connection you have to England.
I hate you. I know lots of things about England. I've been there many times. Well, I've been there 3 times at least. I
No,
love their I
Marvin wins
love
the
their
book for
humor.
me. Marvin wins the book for me. He's so funny in every scene that
I agree with that. He is amazing in every scene. Every line that comes out of Marvin is gold.
let's go through. So this is a very short book. This book is under 200 pages. And I by the way, I am very pro short books. I'm pro short media. I'm pro 90-minute movies. I'm pro 200 to 250 page books. I am pro novella. I am for things being a little bit shorter. Not everything, in my opinion, needs to be a GD 700 page epic or a 3.5. Looking at you, Martin Scorsese, on your streaming platforms. They don't all need to be 3 hours, man. Like, it's okay if they're not. You don't
I agree
necessarily
with
have 3
you.
hours worth of interesting story to tell.
I think that there is a time and a place for long books, and there are some things I have, there are some long books that I've read that, like, even then I got to the end and I was still disappointed that it ended, 500, 600 pages in, and you still have that feeling of like, oh, when you finish.
I'm
But
reading a
there
Thomas
is,
Pynchon book right now
oh,
that
wow, yeah. Those
is
are
like four, it's like
long.
400 pages, and I'm sort of just like, I, this could be, this gains nothing by the length, not
Right.
better for it. I'll criticize Pynchon, I don't care. It's too long. It's too long.
No, I'm with you. There are things that I have read that, and we talked about that with Confederacy of Dunces. That wasn't something that
Too
was
long.
edited,
No.
right? O'Toole wrote that book, and unfortunately took his life, and it was passed on to a
Walker
publisher.
Percy.
And it was just straight up published, and that book would have benefited from some editing. It definitely did not need to be as long as it was for the type of book that it was. It could have, I mean, could it have been the under 200 or just at 200 pages that this book is? Probably not quite. But it could have been a shorter read,
This
for
one is
sure.
exceedingly short. Like I've
This is very short, but I have to say, I mean, I agree with you. Like, I don't think everything should be short. It's not like, oh, all movies and books should be shorter. There's a benefit to some things being long, but there's a real satisfaction in just breezing through a 200-page book
Yes.
and then putting it down and being like, you know what? That was great. And then you move on to a new book.
I also think this would, I think this more so than a lot of other narratives would suffer from being too long. Like, I think this goes down pretty smooth at just under 200 pages. I think if you had 350 pages of, like, you can buy an omnibus of all five or six books. That I think would wear thin. I don't think you would enjoy it as much if you were to read it straight through all six of them or all five of them, because I think there's multiple omnibus versions, depending on when they were collected and like in the publishing cycle. I think that it would be less enjoyable for me anyway as a reader if I were to like back to back four of these.
I can see that. And that brings me to a quick little anecdote that I wanted to share. That I
Wait,
wanted
can
to
I share one
share.
with you just so we're talking
Oh,
about
but
length?
yes, please go ahead first because we're still talking about length.
The first podcast I was going to pitch you was going to be called Book Slog, and it was going to be just really, really long books. And then as I was like kind of outlining the books and like how this would go down, I was just sort of like, this sounds like it's no fun at all. This sounds like it would just be like a I even recognize so much so that I put slog in the title of it that I came up with.
Yeah.
It was going to be called Book Slog, and it was just going to be like everything over 500, like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, Gravity's Rainbow, just speaking of Thomas Pynchon, just these very, very like long tomes. And I think probably wisely, I didn't even ask you about it, but that was
No,
that was
all
my
of the
first
podcasts would be
podcast.
like, we'd have to do like four podcasts for each book.
Yeah, it was going to be
Or
like
they would
four
eat, or
parts.
they'd be like 6 hour long podcasts and nobody
No,
would
it was
want to
going to,
listen to
yeah,
them.
that was how I was going to pitch it. It was like four parters for every book.
No, I got to mix it up because there is, I mean, because that is a thing with like longer. Sometimes I can read a longer book that I am legitimately enjoying, that I think the book is good and a worthy read, and it still feels like a slog because it's just, it does, it feels never ending.
I was reading Infinite Jest was one of the things that was probably the tipping point where it was a tipping point for both things. I was like, this would be an interesting podcast. And then like 200 pages later, where I'm still only in the first third of the book or however long that stupid thing is, I was like, oh, I don't want to do this at all. This is just not, this wouldn't be fun.
Or recently, you and I discussed Brad Easton Ellis's most recent book, The Shards, that was like 400 pages, and like 200 pages in, it was just like, I don't care what happens. I'm not enjoying this
Girl, that does
book.
not, yeah.
And let me tell you, it is rare. It is super rare that I will put something down and not finish it. I have to
I'm the
read.
same. I will
I
punish
have hate
myself.
read. Oh, I will hate read something. I will hate read it. I will hate
I'll
read
hate watch a
a
movie.
500-page book.
I'll hate read a book, and I will hate finish a series just because I started it and like I need to see it through.
And
The
Bretty Sinellis's
Shard.
most recent book, I absolutely could not do it. I asked you the ending and I took it back to the library because I just couldn't do it. It was too long. I wasn't enjoying it. I didn't think it was good. That could have been a 200-page book and it would have been great. Well,
Yeah,
maybe
no.
great. Great. I know, you know what? I actually think if that was a short book,
No.
it would have been great and I would have straight up enjoyed reading it.
It would
Even
have been.
based on the end that you told me, in a shorter book, I'd have been like, well, that was fun.
He has a problem with that in general. Glamorama is way too long, and that's also the weakest of his books, in my opinion. But Glamorama is too long. American Psycho is too fucking long.
American Psycho is also too long. We could cut some things out.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on and on, and I get it. Going on and on and on is part of that book's narrative device. It is part of the way that character thinks and talks to us as the narrator.
And that's why that book works and is really good, and
Yes.
Glamorama and The Shards are both trash.
Yeah, I
Trash.
mean,
I'm using the word trash. And I'm not apologetic about it.
I'm sure he doesn't think of his work this way, but it's wealthy people being disillusioned by things in nice clothes and doing reprehensible things and like being disenchanted and disengaged with it all. Like it is
Yeah, no, that's the theme. That's solid.
whatever little pulse of meaning in the sorrow that was there in Less Than Zero was sort of a one trick pony, right? Like you can't keep, like I don't keep finding a sorrowful meaning at the bottom of each of these shallow, shallow, vain characters. The Shards I was enjoying for like 250 pages, and
Yeah, no,
then
at first it was like, oh, cool, here we are, we're back. It's just like kind of like we're like kind of revisiting like Less Than Zero or the Rules of Attraction, which were good. And then it just goes on and on and on and on, and
yeah.
nothing happens, and I hated it. And I had to, I just couldn't. I just decided I didn't, you know, I had books to read for the podcast. I have The New Yorker every week, and I couldn't. It felt like a waste of my time, to be honest.
I enjoyed Lunar Park. I think the
Lunar Park
most of his
is
late career, of his later career
agreed.
books, that's the one that I think shows a maturity in storytelling, catching up to like himself and still maintains the sort of style and pulpy, trashy sort of subject matter that we're there for.
Okay, but anyways, sorry. That was a brief foray into Bretty Sinellis, and I'm really glad that we did not decide to do Books Log podcast. I think that reading pop classics is a much better idea, and there will be some slogs. So if those of you are out there being like, "Man, I love when a book is 700 pages," we'll do one. Don't worry. We'll do some long, you know, there will be some longer ones in here, 'cause again, like I think that they have value, but I like to change up the length of things that I'm reading. So if I go through and I read a book that's 700 pages that I've enjoyed or felt like it was a valuable book and was worth the time, I probably am not following that up with another 600 or 700 page book. I'm probably going to pick up something like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, something that I can zip through a little bit more, or even pick up something that's 350 pages that again you can zip through faster than, you know, a 700 page book.
No, I will certainly read long books. Weirdly, Confederacy of Dunces is going to be the first book, no matter what, because it's like,
That's not that well. I mean, it's kind of long for what it is. It is a little bit of a slog because it needs to. It would have benefited from some editing had that book come to us in a different way.
I also just thought it's not as long as some of the other ones that I had on the list, but it is long. And again, I thought it was just a well-known enough title that it would be the easiest one to begin with, given the fact that it's kind of like a straight comedy,
Yeah.
rather than wading in to the Fountainhead, like right,
Right.
episode one, and trying to parse Ayn Rand.
Jumping right into, you know, 30-page monologues with Ayn
I
Rand.
do. I know. I mean, very few people can write a 15-page monologue the way 15-page monologue the way she can, and actually, most people don't try, maybe for reasons. Of her books, though, that's the one to read.
The Fountainhead. Yeah, and I'm looking I know we're I think we've talked about doing that one on this podcast, and I am looking forward to reading it because I think I started it when I was younger, and I maybe just it was maybe over my head. Maybe I started it in like high school or something and was just a little too
It's stupid long, but she writes like such like romance novel prose. Like you chew through it like it's cotton
the
candy.
subject matter or something was maybe just over my head, or I like we've talked about I've at least have talked about this before in the podcast. I feel like sometimes you pick up a book and it's just not the time for you to read it.
Yeah, I mean,
You
The
know,
Fountainhead's
whatever's going
also
on,
about
is it
the
something just doesn't like it's like it's you know, it's not like, oh, I'm not enjoying this or I don't understand it or I don't want to finish it. Sometimes it's just like, oh, you know, you start something and it's just like it doesn't grab you, right? And then you pick up that same book up 3 years later, 6 months later in different circumstances, and you're really into it. So I don't remember what happened with it. I just was much, much younger when I tried to read it. I don't recall that I finished it. So
the struggle of an artist and creator against the conformity and homogenization of commercial architecture in early 60s America is also sort of a subject matter that probably doesn't appeal to a lot of 15-year-olds,
That's fair.
or however old you were at the time. But it is an easy read. It's just a long read.
But that so my antidote, so we were talking about the omnibus of the Hitchhikers series, like kind of reading them all together and how it is kind of better, you know, again, because they're fun. So like a little fun, snappy read is like I agree with you that like I don't know that I would want to read 600 pages of this. So that brings me to this little anecdote. So high school friend of mine came to stay with their family, which included two young boys, the oldest of which was 14. And I this was a couple weeks ago, so I had Hitchhikers out in the kitchen because I read in my dining room for uninteresting reasons. Anyways, and I heard, oh, who's reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? And I heard it in that voice that readers know, where you see that somebody's reading like the same book as you, or something you've just read, or something you loved, and that excitement of like, oh, somebody else reads. Somebody reads a thing that I've read. Somebody's reading or has read a thing that I've read and I want to talk about. So like I heard that tone and I, you know, the reader in me like perked up. And we had been talking about the fact that I started this podcast, and so I said, oh, you know, it's me. I said, you know, my brother and I are doing it for our next podcast, and he was just saying that, you know, that he really loved it. And you know, we chatted about it. He's going to listen to the podcast when it comes out, so now he's going to hear himself on this podcast. But he mentioned that he had read, I think maybe he said he got through like four of them, and it's not that he wouldn't go back to finish it, but I think that was what happened with him. It was just like, you know, he had read through them, and then I think it got a little,
There's
he
also
needed to move. He needed to move into something else. You know, it was just sort of like, oh, you know, I read them, and you know, it just fell off for him a little bit. And I
there's
think it's
diminishing
probably,
returns in the
yeah.
series. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Restaurant at the End of the Universe are the two best ones. They go together. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy ends with the line, "We're going to stop and get a bite to eat." I'm paraphrasing. "We're going to stop and get a bite to eat at the restaurant at the end of the universe." Taking us directly into the next book, which were, I believe, created around the same time, and they tell one overarching story. Then he wrote the third one, Life, the Universe, and Everything, which was adapted from an old Doctor Who episode that he never got on the air when he ran one of the series for that. Doctor Who also being something that is very, very British. The British love that show. It's been on for, I think it's been on since the British were fighting the colonies, as we were known back in the 1700s. I think that's when Doctor Who first aired, and they've kept it on ever since then. But he adapted the third one from a script he had for Doctor Who. Those three are good. The fourth and fifth ones are kind of like, if you like this sort of thing, you might enjoy them, but like those first three are the kind of the bangers.
Yeah. So yeah, so and part of the reason I wanted to share that is because as an older reader who has always been a reader, I always get excited. I just get excited to know that, like, A, that the younger generation is reading things, brings me joy, and that they would be reading something, to be reading something older like this. And I just kind of think it speaks to, like we were talking about in the introduction, sort of like the lasting like zeitgeist of this book, right? That we have somebody who is, that we still have like intelligent 14-year-olds reading this book, when, like you were an intelligent 14-year-old a lot of years ago reading this book. So I just like, you said, like Elon Musk is out here like naming spaceships for it and stuff. And
This has
this
the
younger generation is still also looking at this and just being like, this is, this is a fun, it, this is a cool, fun science fiction book, to
finding
read.
someone reading this, I can imagine his tone. It's like finding it's like for Big Lebowski fans, it's like when someone else is a Big Lebowski fan and you're like, you get it. You get it, man.
Yes.
Like you're the guy or you're the lady, you understand. Like we are kindred in our appreciation for this thing. And the Hitchhikers, like world universe series, all of them have a very similar thing. Like when you find someone who really likes it, you realize you have found a kindred soul and someone who finds joy in some of the same things you do and has an appreciation for things that could be not to everyone's taste. Like, I don't know. Gags about Vogon poetry being so bad that you'd rather be thrown out of an airlock.
Oh,
I have
and that brings me
actually.
to, because you just said, because you just brought up the Big Lebowski, and this was also a word from Eleanor Oliphant when we were talking about the vocabulary in Eleanor Oliphant, that the word micturate or micturations,
Micturate.
micturate
Yeah.
and, or micturations is also in this book. And so I highlighted it and I made a little note because we talked about it in Eleanor Oliphant, and for anyone, again, if you didn't listen to Eleanor Oliphant, or if the word micturate didn't stand out in your brain after that podcast, to micturate is to urinate. And then we talked about how that's, Kennedy knew that word from the Big Lebowski, because it's mentioned that his rug in the beginning is micturated on. And then it shows up in the Vogon poetry. Again, in my copy, it's page 65. When the Vogons, starts to regale them with his horrible poetry. And I think it says a lot about poetry being terrible if it has anything in it about urination.
And the line is, "Thy micturations are to me as plurtled gabble blotchets on a lurged bee."
Ooh, and it rhymes.
So, as long as we're on the poetry section, at the top of that chapter, there's a little throwaway line, the second paragraph, that says, "The very worst poetry of all perished along with its creator, Paula Nancy Millstone Jennings of Greenbridge, Essex, England, in the destruction of the planet Earth." So I had to look this up because I was like, oh, poor Paula Nancy Millstone Jennings. So originally, when this was aired on BBC Radio, this name was, and I'm not, I don't have the exact name here in front of me, but it was like, Paul Jennings of Greenbridge, Essex, England, and then it gave a full address. And it was a real guy that Douglas Adams was friends with and went to college with. And he just threw it in there as a gag to his buddy that he wrote the worst poetry on earth. Like it was a guy that he was like a writer and a friend of his, like I think a friendly rival on top of that when they were in university together. So it was Paul Jennings, whatever, but he gave his full address. And I guess Paul thought it was very funny, except for the full address part, because he was like, people rang me up, man. You gotta cut that out. You can't give them my home address. And later editions changed it to Paul and Nancy Millstone's Jennings. But that's where
Nice.
that came from, is it was his actual buddy Paul, I guess, at the time.
Oh, that's fun. That's a fun little anecdote.
You want to do just some favorite part? I have some.
I do, and I have
So
and I do
Marvin,
have
I
Oh
went a
yeah, go
little.
ahead.
I just I went a little early with my like Marvin wins the book for me. Do you have someone who wins the book for you?
I have someone who wins the book for me.
It's a way of saying what is like, you know,
Who's my like favorite character, right? Like
or your favorite part, like what wins the book for you?
for me, it's the conversations. I will tell you what it is. I know exactly what it is. It's the conversations between Arthur and Ford. It's
Okay.
their back and forth. It's their like little Monty Python-esque dialogue, back and forth. And I will, there's one that I wanted to. There's like a little conversation that I wanted to pull up. So you go with yours, and then I'll go with mine.
The nootropic, particularly that is described as making a drink that is almost but not quite entirely unlike tea. And I like the playful use of negatives, I guess maybe is that
Oh
it's
yeah,
not that
that's
it
going to
tastes
come up for
almost
me later
like
too.
tea. It's not that it tastes almost like tea. It almost tastes entirely not like tea, but there is this tiny little residual piece of tea flavor in the tea it makes, which is so specific and also, I imagine, infuriating. Like if there was something that like somebody called Coca-Cola and you tasted it and you were like, it would be so much worse if it was just like there's just a lingering aftertaste of Coke and nothing else.
Yeah.
Like that extra, I think that's like just a funny gag. I like the callbacks over and over again to the Pangalactic Gargle Blaster. It's mentioned
The
in one of the guide entries, and then yes, when they're talking about the guy who started looking for all the missing ballpoint pens on the planet, he was studying something else, but then after a night of drinking Pangalactic Gargle Blasters with
with
Zaphod.
Zaphod.
Yeah, I like that. I actually really like the Zaphod Trillian Arthur connection, even though it's this little throat, like this thing that's barely in there and that exists only just for that one meeting. But I like Arthur's explanation. It's like he didn't have a second head back then, but it's him, which is just delivered so flat. Like it's just such a
Yep.
dry delivery. A guy with his two heads are kind of never mentioned. I mean, it's mentioned, of course, like we know that he has two
They're
heads. So.
mentioned, but they're mentioned very casually. Yeah, they're mentioned very casually.
I really like the two philosophers who demand that deep thought be broken down because, or be turned off because if deep thought is allowed to come up with the answer to life, the universe, and everything, they're out of a job. I like the way that that's like just presented as this sort of like union's going to get upset that they're going to get put out of work by deep thought. And I also just, I don't, the, what is it, Vroom Fondle and Magic Thief are the two names, which I think is very funny. And the fact that one of them just cannot, like, it is a very Monty Python. I guess this comes out of that school of thought. He worked with them, but the, all right, bald Vroom Fondle banging on a nearby desk. I am Vroom Fondle, and that is not a demand. That is solid fact. What we demand is solid facts. No, we don't, exclaimed Magic Thief in irritation. This is precisely what we don't demand. Scarcely pausing for breath, Vroom Fondle shouted, "We don't demand solid facts. What we demand is a total absence of solid facts. I demand that I may or may not be Vroom Fondle." Their whole two pages are just great. I liked all of that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. I really enjoyed their back and forth. And again, I feel like that's like that British humor, that like kind of back and forth.
And my last one is I like that. Obviously, I like that the answer is 42. And that then they have to try to build something to come up with a question.
Did they have
I
to,
like.
right? Did they have to figure out what is the question to the answer?
I like an author just like giving their characters no breaks whatsoever. And I like that they get an answer and then they need like another 20,000 years of building the computer Earth to find out what the question is. But I like that the mice in particular on their way out are just like, just think of a question. Think of any question. It's like, how many roads must a man walk down? He's like, hey, that sounds like something. That sounds just vague enough to be kind of philosophical and just enough like something that like, you know, a bunch of people will like glom onto it. I also like that that's all a slight dig at Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Because he could be knocked off his pedestal as far as I'm concerned.
And
Not
people do.
all the way, that just he could come down a peg or two.
He could come down a little bit. Yeah, I like that. It's like they've done this whole experiment, experiment with Earth and all this work that's gone into it. And then yeah, like in the end, when everything, goes to hell, then it's just like, we'll just come up with a question. Because that's all it is. That's all they need to do is come up. Like after all that, they realize they can just make something up.
And like also like one of the first things one of them might suggest is what 6 times 7? No, like he seriously
Yeah.
suggests that, and the other one's like too literal. No, bad pitch.
So I mentioned that the dialogue specifically between Ford and Arthur is like something that wins the novel for me. So when Earth is blown up and they wake up on like the Vogon ship, Arthur asks, "How did we get here?" "We hitched a lift." We hitched a lift," said Ford. "Excuse me," said Arthur. "Are you trying to tell me that we just stuck out our thumbs and some green bug-eyed monster stuck his head out and said, 'Hi, fellas, hop right in. I can take you as far as the Basingstoke roundabout.'" "Well," said Ford, "the thumb's an electronic sub-ether signaling device. The roundabout's at Barnard's Star, 6 light-years away. But otherwise, that's more or less right. And the bug-eyed monster is green, yes." That and I just love that. Again, that to me is just like that quintessential UK humor, because I know things about the UK besides Harry Potter, like their
Well,
humor.
Harry Potter and this, and Eleanor Oliphant.
And Eleanor Oliphant. That was Scottish. Anyways,
That's true.
but
I
yeah.
also like, by the way, that's it. Like, I don't need to know how they got on the ship. It's not relevant to me. The thing in his bag and poof, they're on the ship. That works. Like, I don't need to go deep.
I don't
This
need to
isn't
go
the kind of
deep. I
book
don't
that
need
would do that,
to go
but
deep into the sci-fi of it.
no.
I'm also satisfied with like that. Oh, this is a sci-fi book. We can suspend our reality, right? We can suspend our belief and just kind of take what comes at us in this book. And that's fun. He does a really good job with this and makes it like, this is fun sci-fi to me. If I had read this when I was younger, it could have changed my opinion of sci-fi. But as I said, when I was younger, I was sometimes just like less inclined to sort of branch out of, I was a little less inclined to like branch out genre wise. Like maybe I read like a science fiction book that I didn't like and was just like, I don't think I like science fiction. I don't think I like fantasy books. And so I like didn't read a lot of those for years. And as I got older and read for reasons besides pleasure, I mean, pleasure is a big part of reading, but I mean, I do sometimes read things that are like different, or I try to expand what I'm reading because we also read to learn things and to get different viewpoints. And that, that's just like I guess maybe a more adult perspective, at least on my behalf of reading. But if I'd read this when I was younger, I would have maybe been more inclined to pick up science fiction books here and there if the subject matter appealed to me.
I think though to your to I there is a lot of bad sci-fi out there, I think. I think sci-fi and fantasy both have a terrific volume of shit available in those respective genres. And then a narrower shelf of like the real heavy, like the real good stuff. Like I think there's a lot of bad sci-fi.
And I
Just like
guess
there's a lot of bad fantasy.
when you're getting into these specific, I mean, there's a lot of terrible books in the world, right? There's just like a bunch of stuff out there that's some real crap. It's amazing sometimes what gets published. So that's a good point. And I guess when you're getting into those like more specific, when you're getting maybe into these more specific genres, you're right. There is like maybe more of a limit on what is truly good and has maybe some sort of like literary value, and what you can just kind of slap together and people will pick up and read.
And maybe I should clarify to say, I think sci-fi and fantasy that has like broad appeal outside of the fans of the genre. Because I think the reason they have such a dump truck full of bad books and bad stories is because there are people who will just read, who just like that genre and read all of it. Like I
Yeah,
think.
okay. Yeah, there are people who kind of only read fantasy, or they only read sci-fi.
when you're on Goodreads and you see those people whose reading challenge, they've knocked out like 300 books in a year. A lot of them are just cranking through like just kind of cheap fantasy novels. Like they grind them out. They do like one every 2 days.
Right.
Like
Yeah, and that's like a similar thing with like what we would consider like airport reads.
Yeah, romance novels I think have a very similar like
I was
thing. There's
actually
people
also
who
going to
just
say
want to
that.
read that genre. They don't really care if it's magnificent. They don't care if it's
Right.
enlightening. This is what they do instead of, I don't know, watching Survivor. Like they read these things,
Right.
and it doesn't really matter if they're super original over and over again. They just like it. And I think
That's
that's
true.
why they've got these
Or the like lawyer, not like, law novels.
Yeah,
Right,
I think
yeah.
there's
Like,
some, yeah. I
who's
think
that guy?
sci-fi has that, fantasy and romance all have ardent fans who just want this regardless of, the actual quality of it. It doesn't, that's less important than getting tone, tropes, and like certain aspects of the world and the genre itself correct.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's good. That's interesting. That's a really good point. Okay, so something else that won the book for me, so was their dialogue, and then again, this kind of goes on how they just like show up on the Vogon ship. Like we don't have a lot of specifics. Are like I so my little note says our heroes and heroes is in quotations. Our heroes just get lucky. They don't have skills. They're not heroes. They're just stumbling around.
No,
They get picked up on they get picked up on the
yeah.
Heart of Gold because of the improbability drive, which has like that 0 to infinity chance, right, of happening or whatever.
Which I feel like is in there
In the end, when they're cornered.
as a nod to just like the Deus Ex Machina of like fiction in general. That like, look, I need them to get on this ship, so boom, they're on the ship because of the improbability drive, because it's
Right.
improbable that the characters in genre fiction in general would keep crossing each other's paths like this. Like I feel like it's a little bit of a nod to the way that a lot of these books are constructed.
Yeah, sure. I kind of like we talked about in Little Fires Everywhere, we were talking about like the courtroom scenes, and stuff, and it's like this just isn't what would be brought up in a court. Like this isn't what they would be talking about, but it has but like we need this as like a tool. We need it as a tool to move the story forward. We need it as a tool for like some of the conversation and the points the author wants to make, and to give us these different sides and views, in there.
She still should have put it somewhere else. It
I
just
agree with you.
she could have picked any other device to have that conversation present in that novel. Anyway, we already litigated that
She
particular
could have.
book,
We've
but
already talked exactly. We've already talked
yeah.
about that. However, but yes, and in the end, they just happen to get away. Everything just
Yeah.
kind of happens, right? Like they just fall into good luck. We have no idea why these two guys that are holding them at gunpoint and shooting at them collapse. We find out it's because Marvin's talking to their ship, their
Yeah.
machine, and the machine heals itself because Marvin's so horrible and depressing. So yeah, I like that there's like they don't have skills. In Fort
Nope.
Prefect, Zaphod Beeblebrox, they don't have skills. They're not idiot characters by any means, but like they don't have smarts. They're not fantastically smart. They don't have superpowers. They don't have some device that, the Heart of Gold, I guess, is a pretty powerful device, but like aside from that, they don't have these like devices or powers that they've been given that things keep working out, or they don't get themselves out of situations. Things just happen.
Yeah, things just happen. The four of them are mostly there in this book anyway, just to be reactionary and to serve as ciphers for information the author wants us, the reader, to get so that he can set up more gags and set up more like skits and bits with other aspects of the universe. But no, they just end up on Ford's cousins. His sort of cousin, whatever the relationship is with him and Zaphod, ends up on his ship that he stole as the president of the universe. There's a bit in there that there's a description of Zaphod of Beeblebrox of like no one would have thought he could be president. He was vain. He was self-aggrandizing. He was mostly just self-promotional. And the only reason he would have wanted to be president really was to like make money and run some scams. There were, when Trump was first elected president, like a ton of hot take little articles about how Trump was Zaphod Beeblebrox. That was a, if you look up Zaphod and Trump, there's actually just a, it's like pages of them come up of people being like, Trump is Zaphod Beeblebrox. That's who he is.
Oh, that's amazing. Because I was reading that, in this book, being like, I mean, and I mean, so Trump obviously sprang to mind, but I mean, like majority of like a lot of politicians, like that to me is a little bit of a description of politicians, right? Like
well,
that's,
I think that's why
how
it's
I
in
read
the,
it. And I'm sure
yes,
that's why
in the
it's in the
book.
book,
Yeah.
of course. But sure, Trump is obviously the a real outstanding
Yeah, I
example
mean, yeah,
of
like the
that.
last decade, he's the one that, like, I guess, I like how many people went to this. Like, this book's 45 years old, and like, it's still relevant enough in people's mind that there were just a ton of hot take articles that came out still referencing this character as though he was current,
Right. Or like I
referencing
said,
Zaphod.
Apparently, like, you know, high school kids are still out here reading and enjoying this book, which that brought me a lot of joy.
This is one of those books that you've had to hear this TED talk before, but in high schools and stuff, just give kids books they might actually like reading. Stop assigning Moby Dick.
Nobody wants to read Moby Dick.
Moby Dick sucks. Also, I gotta tell you, I don't know that it's that great of a book. I've read it. No one liked it when it came out. No one liked it for the decades after it came out. One day, William Faulkner randomly announced that in his opinion, it was the great American novel, the greatest novel ever written. And then we've been stuck with Moby Dick ever since then because people just took whatever Faulkner said at face value. And now they've written all of the teaching materials. Nobody wants to go back and write different teaching materials. So everyone still teaches Moby
It's
Dick.
a good point because
And
if
that
you look,
book just
because if you're
sucks.
talking to people about like things that they've read in school, okay, so The Great Gatsby, for instance, is a good book.
Yeah, I like that one.
The Great Gatsby is a good book that holds up. I read it in high school, and I have read it. I've read it twice as an adult, and my opinion didn't change on it. And a lot of people feel that way. A lot of people read that book in school and liked it, and still like it. Right? A lot of people went to see Leonardo DiCaprio in that movie because they read that book in high school, and they liked it. Right? So it's like it is true. Like if you're giving people a book, if you're giving someone a book that you're forcing them to read, and it is a good book, that is going to change their opinion on reading. Whereas like when you give some 13-year-olds Moby Dick and it's super long and it doesn't have a lot of relevance, like The Great Gatsby has kind of like lasting relevance, I think. Right? So it's a book that takes place in the 20s. In the 20s, it's a book that takes place in the 20s, so 100 years ago at this point, but like it holds relevance, it holds weight, and it holds water. People can see themselves in these like stories and these books and stuff, I think. And like
it also describes an America that they understand and know. Class striving, class struggle.
Yes, that's a very good point. Yes, exactly.
Relationships between romantic relationships that have a tinge of business, romantic relationships that are born out of passion versus some that are born out of convenience. All of this reflects a world that they actually know, whereas the long tail understanding that the whaling industry kind of reflects modern capitalism. After you wade through all of the minutiae in that book, and I guess when you get to college, there is something to be learned from taking a large text and breaking it down and pulling the pieces out of it. But there's just, we mentioned Infinite Jest earlier. Just do it to Infinite Jest. Like, it's at least set in a world in an America with a satire and a, it desperately wants to be the great American novel anyway. It's only been written for someone to dissect it the way you dissect Moby Dick. You sure as hell can't read it for pleasure. Just elect something else. Moby Dick sucks.
Elect something else. Personally, I think Salvage the Bones. I think we could replace it with Salvage the Bones.
Sure.
What a great story, right? Just like what you want the great American novel. Let's look at a lot of different American experiences, because you know what my experience hasn't been being on a whaling ship. That has nothing to do with my American experience. And my dad was in the And my dad was in the Navy.
A lot of the book doesn't take place on America.
Yes, exactly. My dad was in the Navy, and I don't care about this book that takes place on a ship and has to do with a whale, right? Like, you know, we don't have it, you know, let's take Salvage the Bones. That takes place here, and it takes place here in America. It's more modern. And again, that's a story. You want to give me an American story, show me someone, so show me different parts of America, show me different kinds of people that live here. Or the Handmaid's Tale. Again, I mean, that was a book I read. That's a book people enjoy. That's a book people read in high school that people can see. You could see parallels to society today, right? So like those are examples of like books that have like a lasting relevance and I think a lasting impact on people that read them, whereas like the lasting impact for Moby Dick was how much you hated it because it was boring.
Or like, I don't know, those Henry James novels. I read Daisy Miller not too long ago. You ever read Daisy
I
Miller?
haven't, but you and I talked about it.
She's like a brash young woman who like goes against society, and like society tells her don't go down to the malaria pits, and she's like, I'm a brash young woman, I don't do what society says. And so she goes down to the malaria pits. And then she gets malaria.
That
She dies.
feels, yeah.
That's the book. She pushed back against society. She went to the malaria pits. Guess what happens to
I
her?
feel like,
She dies of friggin' malaria.
yeah.
It's good advice. Stay out of the malaria
That is
pits.
good advice.
They're called malaria pits. They weren't called something else. It wasn't like a dance hall that was ironically named the malaria pit. It was a pit where everyone gets malaria, and she wouldn't stay out of
Kind of sounds like Daisy Miller had it coming.
it. Are you playing the malaria
You
pits?
know.
You're gonna get malaria.
Okay. I do have one more quote for okay, to back to Hitchhiker's Guide. I do have one more quote now that we're off our soapbox. TED Talks about what should be taught in high schools. But I would agree with you. This would be a fun book. Give this to some kids in English class and let them write a paper on it so that they think that reading can be fun. Remember we talked about
Yeah, give it to ninth graders for like they'll be done in a week.
But anyways, okay, so back to Hitchhiker's Guide. I do have one quote, and it kind of goes along with one of the ones with what you read about the tea. And this is about the ships that blast Earth out of the way for the intergalactic highway. The ships hung in the sky in much the same way that bricks don't. Yeah, and I
That one,
just
Mark.
you know, and that's early, you know, that's early on in the book. Again, in my book, it's page 33. My copy is page 33, and I just like. That's good writing. I like stuff like that. That's good writing.
Another quote I have, which I think is just indicative of like the fun in the text of this book. The ravenous bug bladder beast of Trall, a mind-bogglingly stupid animal. It assumes that if you can't see it, it can't see you. Daft as a bush, but very, very ravenous. Just
Yeah,
doubling down on
I
ravenous.
But very, very rad. But rest assured, ravenous.
Can I point out the quote that you just read, the ships hung in the sky in much the same way that bricks don't? Hilarious. I loved it. There's a one-line paragraph and still nothing happened. The paragraph after that though has like a really well-crafted description of the PA's of the sound before an announcement is made, where it says, then there was a slight whisper, a sudden spacious whisper of open ambient sound. Every hi-fi set in the world, every radio, every television, every cassette recorder, every woofer, every tweeter, every mid-range driver in the world quietly turned itself on. The description,
Yeah,
you can imagine
absolutely.
that sound in your head, right? That sort of a slight whisper, a sudden spacious whisper of open ambient sound.
Yeah.
That's what that thing is when you first turn on a
Sure.
stereo, and that, like, I don't know, I
It is well
it's really
described.
well described after that
The
hilarious
ship's hanging in
line
the
about
sky.
ships hanging in the sky much the way that
So,
bricks don't.
you know, a final thought. Well, actually, I have one more quote to read, so not a final thought, but a coming to the end thought is that something else I think that makes this good, that makes this a classic, is that he's a good writer because of things like that. His descriptions, the clever turns of phrase, or like you know, doubling down on ravenous, you know, just to make something funny. But he's a good writer. And it allows this book to be silly and not stupid.
I think that's probably true.
And to make it a fun book, but like you still feel like you've read something that's good and worthwhile.
He describes the streets filled with people cheering when Deep Thought's about to give the answer as looking like centipedes rolled over on their backs and frantically waving their legs in the air.
Oh, I liked that too. Yeah.
Which, if you're like looking down, if you ever see like an aerial shot of like crowded streets,
I think I also marked
that's really
that.
appropriate.
The last quote that I have, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about, where he does have a few things in here that are like kind of profound. So Arthur and Slarty Bart Fast are in. Oh, I have to go through my names, by the way. I still
By
have
the
my
way.
list. That's what I'm going to end with. But anyways, they're deep into Magrathia, right? And so they're going and realizing how like huge Magrathia is. And so they're going into the room where the new Earth that they're building, the new planet Earth that they're building is being constructed. So they're in this like cavernous, huge room. And as they come into it, it says the car shot forward straight into the circle of light, and suddenly Arthur had a fairly clear idea of what infinity looked like. It wasn't infinity, in fact. Infinity itself looks flat and uninteresting. Looking up into the night sky is looking into infinity. Distance is incomprehensible and therefore meaningless. The chamber into which the air car emerged was anything but infinite. It was just very, very, very big. So big that it gave the impression of infinity far better than infinity itself. I thought that was kind of profound, since we have Slarty Bartfast name shortly above it.
Which
that name might be what won the book for me.
So fantastically terrible. As long as we are on Magrathia, I like the sign. The slogan is whatever your tastes, Magrathia can cater for you. We are not proud. As someone who's worked in the service industry, that resonated with me. Slarty Bartfast has some of my favorite lines in the book, which I think the one that sort of sums up the philosophy of the book, if the book has a philosophy. He says, I always think that the chances of finding out what really is going on are so absurdly remote that the only thing to do is to say, hang the sense of it and just keep yourself occupied. Look at me. I design coastlines. I got an award for Norway.
I know. I love how much he talks about coastlines and he keeps coming back to like Norway and the fjords.
I'll end my quotes with my favorite one from Marvin, which is, sorry, did I say something wrong? Said Marvin, dragging himself on regardless. Pardon me for breathing, which I never do anyway, so I don't know why I bother to say it. Oh, God, I'm so depressed. My guy Marvin throwing heat.
Okay, I'm going to go through some of the names that I wrote down. This is just a collection of my favorite. Some of them have been mentioned throughout, but it's fun to hear them all together. Poet Master Grunthos the Flatulent. Bambleweenie?
What's Bambleweenie from?
Bambleweenie was just the name of some sci-fi gadget or like machine, something with Bambleweenie, and I just Bambleweenie. That's amazing. That's an amazing word. Say it.
Bambleweenie.
Yeah, don't you? I think. Yeah. And if you're listening right now, go ahead and say it out loud.
If you're listening right now and you are trying to find a name for your band, if you're one of those people, pitch your bandmates on Bambleweenie.
On Bambleweenie. Take a moment to say it out loud to yourself right now in the car or the kitchen, wherever you're listening to this.
Really, you could do a lot worse if you're looking for band names than just kind of going through this book and pulling some stuff for consideration.
Right. And then you're going to have people who want to listen to your band simply because they are fans of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah. Paranoid Android was a really big hit for Radiohead.
All right. My last few names. Okay. So obviously, Slarty Bartfast.
Fantastic.
Amazing. Lunkwill and Fook. And those are the computer geniuses that are talking to deep thought. And then the last one was Roomfondle. Roomfondle. Slarty Bartfast and Bambleweenie are maybe two of my favorite words that exist in this book and maybe in the entire world.
I think didn't IBM name their chess playing robot Deep Thought after Deep Thought with from this series? I believe they did. Or whoever invented that chess playing computer that I think was eventually defeated, but
I think I, yeah, you know what? I think I remember.
it reigned supreme for a little while. They named it Deep Thought.
I think you're right. I mean, at the time, I don't think I knew that it was a Hitchhiker's reference, but yes, I do think it was named Deep Thought. That strikes a chord with me. So I guess that sums up our discussion of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
So would you recommend it?
100%, I would recommend this, and frankly, I'm sad I waited so long to read it.
Yeah, I also recommend. And it's short. It is fewer than 200 pages. You can rocket through this. It's light, it's fun, it's funny. And you'll also probably read things that you will have that sort of strange recognition where you're like, oh, that's what that other thing I heard was a reference to. It comes from this. Like Deep Thought, the chess playing rope,
Right,
the
Deep Thought.
computer.
I know. I'm looking forward to like going through life now, knowing what the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy references are out there in the world. It makes me feel like I'm part of something. That's nice.
All right, what are we doing next?
All right. So next up for all of you Sally Rooney fans, I stand with you, and we are going to do Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney.
I'm looking forward to it.
Is this going to be your first? This is not your first Rooney.
It is not my first Rooney. The sexy one was my first Rooney.
Normal People. And so chosen to go with Conversations with Friends, which is her first novel, and was a real br and was a real breakout
Yes.
novel for her, and it is fantastic.
It is the, I believe, the more popular of her works.
I think so too. And and I think this was something she wrote. We'll discuss it more in the podcast, of course, but like fresh out of college, or like in her senior year of college. So a little bit of like a less than zero kind of thing there, like that she came out with this book really young, and people were just, kind of impressed at the gravity, of her writing. So I'm really looking
Oh, that's
forward to
cool.
like I said, obviously we'll go more into the specifics in the podcast itself, but it is kind of a cool story behind it, and I love Sally Rooney, so I'm really looking forward to getting into this one in a couple weeks.
All right. Well, as always, please, as always, I think I only said it on the, not as always, as I said on the last episode, and as I'm trying to make myself remember to start saying, as always, if you're enjoying this podcast, do the thing in the platform that you're listening to it on that shows affirmation and positive intent, whether that's liking it or thumbs upping it or subscribing to it or whatever the platform you listen on allows you to do to show approval. Please do that. I think it must do something.
I'm sure it's helpful.
Yeah, it, I don't know. It
And it and you know what? Even if it's not helpful, it would make us
petitions the algorithm at the very least.
and it would make us feel good.
Yeah, we'd also appreciate it. And as always, this I do remember to say, you can write us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. And tell us books you think would be good for the series, or things we might have missed, or thoughts you have. All right, we'll see you next time.
And thanks for listening.